I supplied him with parlor matches, and after some last instructions waited the auspicious moment. 241. When Hunter came out she saluted us as usual, and then turned and scrutinized the strange machine with Indian-like hesitancy. I told her what was desired, and she then stepped boldly upon the proper spot, and bent forward to look at the movements of Mr. Pritchard, as his hand moved the poise along the beam. The balance being attained, as we could all plainly hear by the sound of the beam against the pad, she stepped off and passed into the cabinet. A match being struck, Mr. Pritchard read the scale at £138, which caused the audience no surprise, for, as the reader will observe, by reference to the several pictures of Hunter that appear in this volume, she looks like a woman who would weigh from 135 to 145 pounds. But the counterpoise at the end of the beam appeared to me too thin for the 000 pound weight, and upon lighting a second match Mr. Pritchard found that it was only the 50 pound weight, and consequently that the squaw had only weighed 88 pounds. Hunter now reappeared, and I asked her to make herself lighter. She again mounted the platform, and this time it was found that she weighed but 58 pounds. The experiment was repeated a third time, and her weight stood the same as before, 58 pounds. The fourth time the reading of the beam showed 65 pounds. Thus, without any change of clothing, and all within the space of 10 minutes, this spirit, who weighed at the beginning at least 50 pounds less than any mortal woman of her size and height should weigh, reduced her materiality to the extent of 30 pounds, and, after holding it there several minutes, increased it 7 pounds. Of course it would have been infinitely more satisfactory if I could have first peeped into the dark cabinet and then managed the scale myself, for in such case I would not have to report, as to a portion of the facts, upon hearsay testimony. And I leave to Mr. Crookes, Mr. Wallace, and other intelligent observers, more favorably conditioned than I, the task of following up this novel and suggestive inquiry. Mr. Pritchard is a reputable citizen of Albany, N.Y., retired from business in which he accumulated a competency, and I give his affidavit in corroboration of the facts I have narrated. Mr. Pritchard's affidavit. State of Vermont, County of Rutland, S.S. Edward V. Pritchard, of the City of Albany, State of New York, being duly sworn, deposes and says that on the evening of September 23 instant, he attended a séance or circle at the house of the Eddy family, in the town of Chittenden, in the county and state aforesaid, that he was invited to occupy a chair on the platform in a room known as the Circular Room, where certain mysterious phenomena known as spirit materializations occurred, that among other forms presenting themselves and identified by persons in the audience as the shapes of deceased friends and relatives, there appeared the figure of an Indian woman known as Honto, who approached so close to deponent that he distinctly saw every feature of her countenance, and her entire body, that he is well acquainted with William H. Eddy, and avers that the said Honto bore no resemblance whatever to him in any particular. And deponent further says, that a pair of platform scales being previously placed convenient to his reach, the said Honto stood thereupon four separate times for deponent to weigh her, and that, without having apparently changed her bulk, or divested herself of any portion of her dress, she weighed respectively 88 pounds, 58 pounds, 58 pounds, and 65 pounds at the several weighings. And deponent further says that, having weighed the said William H. Eddy upon the same scales, he finds his weight to be 179 pounds. E. V. Pritchard. Subscribed and sworn to before me, this 30th day of September, A. D. 1875, H. F. Baird, Justice of the Peace. In his famous first article in the Quarterly Journal of Science for July, 1870, Mr. Crookes, in enumerating the results that he shall expect the spiritualists to help him to attain, before he can ask his scientific brethren to investigate the phenomena, says, the spiritualist tells of bodies weighing 50 or 100 pounds being lifted up into the air without the intervention of any known force, but the scientific chemist is accustomed to use a balance which will render sensible a weight so small that it would take 10,000 of them to weigh one grain. He is, therefore, justified in asking that a power, professing to be guided by intelligence, which will toss a heavy body up to the ceiling, shall also cause his delicately poised balance to move under test conditions. Again, he says in the same article, the first requisite is to be sure of facts, then to ascertain conditions, next, laws. Accuracy and knowledge of detail stand foremost among the great aims of modern scientific men. No observations are of much use to the student of science unless they are truthful and made under test conditions, and here I find the great mass of spiritualistic evidence to fail. In a subject which, perhaps, more than any other, lends itself to trickery and deception, the precautions against fraud appear to have been, in most cases, totally insufficient, owing, it would seem, to an erroneous idea that to ask for such safeguards was to imply a suspicion of the honesty of someone present. I quote these sensible words, not to help me in my investigations at this place, for my researches are completed, but to call the attention of other investigators in various other portions of the country who may happen to read these lines, to the true method which should guide their researches. The absolute ponderosity of a materialized spirit has at least been suggested by the weighing experiments at Chittenden, and it remains only for those who have access, say, to such compliant and intelligent spirits as Mr. Crookes Katie King, or Miss Showers Florence and Lenore, to make careful supplemental experiments, under test conditions, and thus solve one of the most important problems ever broached to the scientific world. 244. I saw Honto, on one evening, October 15th, melt away as far up as her waist, just as she was ready to pass into the cabinet. Once I saw a long lance, with a tapering steel head and a tuft of drooping ostrich plumes below it, suddenly materialized, in the hand of a male spirit. Once, one of Honto's knitted shawls instantly formed, in a pile, on the floor, before she even stretched her hand towards the place to pick it up, and once a little animal, like a squirrel or a large rat, suddenly appeared, walked about, and disappeared on the platform, almost frightening poor old Mrs. Cleveland out of her wits. If I ask Mr. Crookes to tell me by what law these things happen, he would undoubtedly answer, "Show me 50 such cases, happening under test conditions, and then we will weigh these things on our scales and try to discover the law." George Dix, the sailor spirit, tried to enlighten me upon the subject, one evening. He said that man, in his earth life, is nothing but a materialized spirit, a living entity encased in a covering of flesh. To keep himself and this case together, he must consume and assimilate tons of the material portions of animal and vegetable food. If he stops the process, he becomes dematerialized, or uncased, in a very brief time. On the other hand, spirits can do in a moment what before death it took them years to accomplish, materialize a body to cover them. In the atmosphere they find ready for use, an inexhaustible supply of the same matter as that which exists in the animal and vegetable, only in a diffused and sublimated form, and by a supreme creative effort of the will they instantly collect the scattered particles into such shapes as they choose. 245. What shall we say to all this? That it is silly, useless even if true, impossible, unscientific? Lord Bacon sets it down as a law unto himself, never to reject upon improbabilities until they hath passed a due examination. Benjamin Franklin, when asked in regard to the use of some discovery, retorted, "What's the use of a newborn baby?" Arago, the astronomer, says that he is wanting in prudence who, outside of pure mathematics, pronounces the word impossible, 44 years after Harvey had announced his immortal discovery of the circulation of the blood. A paper was read to the French Academy of Sciences to prove such a thing impossible. See Owen's Footfalls on the Boundary of Another World, p. q. 3, and when Morse asked Congress for an appropriation to make a practical test of his telegraph, the application was treated with derision by some wiseacre statesman, as being too silly to be seriously entertained. Who, then, except our Dr. B.S., can in the face of such examples afford to turn his back upon any of the phenomena presented for our inspection by the class of persons called mediums, who, I mean, that has any reputation for intelligence and fairness to lose. Chapter 16, A Startling Prophecy. On the evening of September 26 last, a prophecy was made in a circle by the spirit Mrs. Eaton, the fulfillment of which will mark an epoch in the history of modern spiritualism. She said that on Sunday, September 19, 1875, in the Eddy Circle Room, spirits would materialize themselves in a brightly lighted room, and deliver orations as in life, with persons sitting all about them on the platform. In short, by that time they would have so far overcome or changed the conditions of the manifestations, that the present annoying drawbacks to a perfect investigation of the phenomena would no longer exist. This will be very satisfactory to those who may follow after me, but it comes too late to be of any service to myself. I have had to feel my way to a conclusion through darkened rooms, and at such a physical distance from the cabinet and its occupants, that I have been like a blind man in a strange city. But, nevertheless, as even he may fare on to his journey's end, if he but tread cautiously and make sure of his foothold before venturing to take the next step, so, in spite of all difficulties, I feel as if, after moving at snail's pace for 2 months, the goal were in sight at last. Did ever a wiseacre muscular contraction theorist hear a spirit speak? Has Dr. Carpenter ever known of unconscious cerebration imparting speech to a reincarnated ghost? Did Sir William Hamilton ever know of a conscious activity of the mind, or latent thought covering itself with a corporeal shape, and give voice to logic and rhetoric? If not, what business has either of them? To say nothing of the minnows who swim beside these great whales in the sea of thought, to pronounce ex cathedra judgment upon phenomena of which these chittenden marvels are a part. I have heard a spirit talk, yes, a score of them, and in 8 different languages, of which I understood 3, so as to know what was said on both sides, while I have had the others translated to me. And on the evening of October 2d I heard one make a speech of 5 minutes. That afternoon, I had accompanied the artist to the graveyard to take a sketch of Mrs. Eddy's grave, and as we turned to come away I remarked to him, that it would be a good test of the genuineness of these Eddy manifestations, if the spirit of Mrs. Eddy would appear that night and make some allusion to our present visit. We agreed to keep the matter to ourselves and see what might come of it. We reached home without meeting any person, and even if we had been seen, it would naturally be supposed that we had merely been taking one of our usual strolls. The evening came, and we met in the circle room at the regular hour. The company numbered 14, and 9 spirits showed themselves. The first was old William Brown, who spoke a few words to his son, then a middle-aged lady named Maria Ann Clark, dressed in dark clothing, then a Mrs. Griswold, who was murdered in Vermont not long ago, and who, upon the occasion of a former visit to this circle room, gave all the details of the crime to an old friend of hers, a Mr. Wilkins, who was present. Then forth stepped Mrs. Eddy herself, and stood the silent and the motionless, looking at the artier and myself, who sat together. She bowed and retired, and we exchanged glances as though not satisfied with the test, but immediately the spirit returned, and evidently addressing her discourse to us, said, "Death, where is thy sting? Graze, where is thy victory?" I had expected her to speak in the whispered accents of old Mrs. Pritchard, Maggie Brown, and certain other lady spirits, but she pitched her voice so high and spoke so loud, that she might have been heard in the largest auditorium in New York City. The surprise was so great, that the unexpected sound thrilled me to the marrow, and I sat staring through the gloom at the woman as I never did at a speaker before or since. She was of a large frame, and had the ample figure that is represented in the portrait published with a former chapter. She wore a white waist and dark skirt. Her hair was in ringlets, as I discovered when she bent forward in profile, in the animation of her discourse. She said, addressing me, "Your writings are true, and be assured the truth will prevail. A thousand spirits are watching your every step, and wishing you Godspeed. They see the rapid spread of truth upon earth, and they and a countless host besides, are helping it on. Go on, my friend, We will welcome you in gratitude and joy when you come to the other world, for daring to tell the truth, and helping to disseminate it. I thank you for your kindness to my children, who have suffered so much and so long for the good cause. It is needless to say that, barring all compliments, I needed no stenographer to fix upon my memory this astounding address, of which I have given only a fragment. She spoke of her own sufferings and trials upon earth, and denounced with bitter and unstinted anger all who slander and persecute mediums, especially her own children. Her remarks showed very clearly the deep and hardly eradicable impression made upon her soul by the treatment she received while living here, and the case offers a subject for the thoughtful consideration of psychologists. As the question of personal identity is one of paramount importance, at any rate in a case of this kind, let me remark that the figure was plainly that of a woman, to say nothing of the voice, which, while partaking of the strong Vermont provincial accent of the whole family, was sharp and in a high key the key of a female voice. Moreover, the lady was recognized by sundry of her former acquaintances in the room, who greeted her, in addition to her children, of whom, there were two present. I have seen this lady several times, and heard her make several speeches. In one of these she said, "I am the mother of these mediums, and they are the children of my body. I want this understood. I want it known that this is no fraud, but a real exhibition of spirit power and spiritual existence. It is for that, that I come back to this scene of my earthly sufferings." Again, on the evening of October 9th, confining her discourse to me, she referred to a conversation I had had that day with the artist about certain subjects for illustrations, and suggested her deathbed scene, where, she said, her children in the spirit world had materialized, and stood beside their surviving brothers and sisters, while her own life was ebbing away. My attention was early called to the question of the dynamics of these eddy spirit manifestations, and after settling the matter of their weight, I determined to attempt to throw some light upon the direct power that the spirits could exert. The spring balance occurred to me, as it did to Mr. Crookes, whose excellent pamphlet I unfortunately could not obtain until some time after my own experiments were concluded, and I accordingly procured two of standard quality, of Mr. L. G. Kingsley, of Rutland, the house that furnished me the platform scales, each of a weighing capacity of 50 pounds. I wished to test the power of the detached hands seen in Horatio's light circle, as the demonstration of power by them would be a more striking and satisfactory test than in the case of the fully materialized forms, into which the question of personation was inevitably more or less entangled. Let the reader refer to the sketch of the light circle, in the 12th chapter, and notice the relative positions of the shawl from the railing, and also where the spirit hand is thrust through the shawl, and where the feet of the sitters are aligned. My experiment was twofold, viz., to ascertain how much the hands could pull horizontally, and how much vertically. One of the balances I fastened with a stout cord to the handrail, allowing a sufficiency of cord to bring the hook of the balance within easy reach of the spirit hand. This was for the horizontal pull. The other I attached to a strong ring, made for the purpose, and screwed into the floor, just between the left foot of the gentleman sitter, and the right foot of the medium. The horizontal pull was tried on the evening of September 30th. The audience numbered 26 persons. The weather outside was rainy and blustering, temperature low, 10 new arrivals that day, and generally the conditions would be regarded as unfavorable. The persons sitting beside Horatio were Mr. Goodsell, of Minnesota, and Mr. Wilkins, of Vermont, whose addresses can be furnished if desired. Some instrument playing and card writing occurred, and the guitar, tambourine, and several bells were thrown over the curtain, after which a left hand was thrust out, and by the opening and closing of the fingers, indicated to me, standing close by, that they were ready for my experiment. I stepped upon the platform and handed the hook to the hand, which grasped it, moved its fingers on and off the hook to get a firm hold, as anyone naturally would, if he were about to exert his full force in that way, and then easily, steadily, and without spasmodic action, compressed the spring until the pointer ran down to the 40-pound mark. To prove that the force had not been exhausted, The spring was held there until I reached out my hand to take back the balance, and then was allowed to recoil as gradually as it had been compressed. 40 pounds, therefore, was the measure of the horizontal pull. The hand was the left one, large, broad, and white. I stood within a foot of it when it pulled, and my attention was attracted to a peculiarity which proved that it did not belong to Horatio's body. Upon the wrist, at the root of the thumb, there were two thin parallel lines of tattooing in blue India ink. Horatio exclaimed, while the spirit was pulling, that it was bracing itself for it by pressing the other hand against his, Horatio's, back, and he gave way to the pressure and leaned slightly forward, as if this were the case. If he had been pulling, he would naturally have leaned back, so as to exert his force against the spring. The vertical pull was made on the evening of October 2D, when I myself sat next to Horatio in the light circle. The hand tonight was the right hand of George Dix, as I recognized by its mutilation in the loss of the little finger. It has been asserted, upon the barest suspicion, that this appearance of the loss of the finger is deceptive, the medium having the trick of bending his down so as to seem, but not in reality to be missing. My answer to this is that this experiment was made with this hand not more than 6 inches from my eyes, and with so good a light in the room that I could read the small figures on the dial with ease. Moreover, I noticed how the skin was drawn down into the cavity of the cicatrix, when the wound had healed. I, furthermore, remarked that the hand was as white as marble, the wrist broad and with no depression where it adjoined the hand, and when the fingers clutched the hook to pull, the inside was partially turned toward me so that I could see the blue veins half concealed beneath the fat, and the projection of the tendons as they contracted in the strain. The pull was steady, as before, but more powerful, for the whole 50 pounds was indicated by the pointer on the dial. The balance was then relinquished, and in testimony of his satisfaction at the result, Dix slapped me heartily on the back and tickled me in the ribs. I said, "It seems as if the spirit could pull 100 pounds more, if the apparatus would allow of it," and assent was given by vigorous pounding upon the table behind me. Mr. Charles Goodsell's address is Howard Lake, Wright Company, Minnesota, and he writes me as follows, about the light circle at which the above events occurred. If you recollect, I was sitting beside Horatio, when you first tried the power of the materialized hand which pulled the spring balance. The indicator showed that it pulled 40 pounds. I know that I held Horatio by the left hand, while his right clasped my wrist. I am positive that it was a left hand that hooked the middle finger into the hook of the balance, and pulled. Furthermore, two hands reached out and patted me on the head and shoulders. While my hands were clasping Horatio's, the iron ring was put upon his left arm, and slipped down onto the back of my left hand. If I had been in any doubt about seeing the baby hand, previously described, there was no occasion for it to continue, for on this occasion the hand of a child touched me in the back, and upon my mentally requesting it to show itself, was thrust out and patted me on the cheek. It disappeared, but when I mentally asked that it might be held at my lips, it came again, and remained there until I could kiss it, for it was said that it was the hand of one who bore to me the tenderest of ties. Several other hands, large and small, women's and men's, wrote cards before my eyes, each being closely scrutinized as it appeared. My senses were wide awake, beyond all question, for this was the first opportunity given me to sit with the medium, in a whole month's sojourn in the house, and I determined that no detail, however slight, should be overlooked. I was more than glad to be able to satisfy myself wholly as to the famous ring test, the philosophy of which the mediums, the spiritualists, and the spirits themselves had tried to explain to me. I had seen the thing done in the light a number of times, the ring dropping from off Horatio's arm, as he sat before me with his hands bound, but all this was not entirely satisfactory to one who was furnishing to a wide circle of readers the materials for the formation of belief, and whose duty was to make no mistake. When the ring test was about to be given, I was requested by the medium to take both his hands in mine and keep a firm hold. It must be remembered that, up to this moment, he had been grasping my bared left arm with his two hands. At the beginning of the séance his hands were very cold, but I noticed that they gradually grew warmer, until, Just before the ring test, a shiver ran through his frame, a sudden chill passed into them and they became icy cold. I never felt hands so cold before, except upon a corpse that had been laid in ice. Our hands crossed, my right holding his right, and his left my left. The iron ring used for the experiment was then exhibited through the shawl by another hand, so that all could see it, and then dropped upon the floor at my feet, striking it with a metallic sound, and rolling off the platform. After all who chose had had an opportunity to examine it, it was passed back, and taken behind the curtain by the detached hand. I then felt an arm and shoulder pressing against my back, as I sat touching the edge of the table behind me, and the ring, and a cold hand that held it touched the bare, warm skin of my left forearm. Another tremendous shock ran through the medium's body, and instantly the iron ring slid down from his arm over my right wrist and hung there. There was just distance enough between our arms for the large ring to touch both his and mine, and at the moment of the shock, it seemed to me that the side of the ring next to Horatio's dissolved into a vapor, while the one next to mine remained solid, for it moved away from my skin directly through his arm, or else opened so as to permit his to pass through its own substance, and the next instant it dangled upon my wrist. This is an astounding story, I know, but everything happened just as described. I neither relaxed my hold upon his hands for an instant, nor lost sight of the smallest detail of the experiment. I was neither psychologized nor deceived, and no theory of muscular contraction is sufficient to explain or cover the facts. The explanation given to me of the phenomenon by a spirit is that, the medium system being negative and the sitters positive, a strong current of a fluid, which, for lack of a better name, they call refined electricity, is sent through from the one to the other, and as it passes through the intermediate metal, being obliged to escape at the poles, it overcomes the cohesion of the particles, and the solid is changed into a vapor. By suddenly reversing this process, the substance is re-solidified, and the ring becomes as it was before. They claim that they have the same control over the cohesion of the particles of our gross matter as they have over what we term gravity, that is, that by an exercise of their own subtle power they can as readily dissolve a solid as they can lift it. Let everyone do as he likes with the explanation, I give it as it was received. I must say that I felt no shock whatever at any time, but perhaps, being so positive as they say I am, the thing worked the other way, and the medium got a charge of my surplus magnetism. One night Mayflower told me, as an evidence of the superior knowledge of the spirits, that she herself could harden and weld copper, and make a small machine that would lift the house we were in, as easily as I could my hat. When I asked her why she would not impart some of her knowledge for the benefit of the world, her reply was that, when our men of science got so far progressed as to lose their empty conceit, and discover that they hardly knew the alphabet of science, and were prepared to learn, these and many more important discoveries would reward them. We must hasten slowly on our path up the Parnassan Hill, learning, little by little, and as the child acquires by degrees to creep, walk, and run, all that goes to make up the sum of human knowledge. There was another, and unsolicited, exhibition of spirit power this evening. In the corner of the recess behind Horatio stood an extra chair, which had not been noticed when the shawls were hung. During the seance this chair was lifted perpendicularly twice or three times directly behind Horatio's head, so as to show above the top of the curtain, and it was at last surmised that they desired to have it taken away, so William Eddy, who was standing nearby, took it from the invisible holder. The perpendicular height of the lift and weight of the chair being ascertained, I allowed 2 seconds as the time consumed in the raising, and then made the following calculation. To arrive at the measure of force exerted chair weighed 834 pounds, perpendicular height 5 feet 5 inches. Time, estimated, 2 seconds. 1 horsepower is 33,000 pounds lifted 1 foot in 1 minute, consequently 8.75 by 30 by 5.16 equals 1,354 33,000/1,354 equals 24.36. or nearly 1/4 of a horsepower. Next to Honto, and old Mr. Brown, the talking spirit, who usually open and close the seances, The spirit I have most frequently seen is that of the mother of Mr. Pritchard, of Albany, who has been recognized over and over again, not only by him, but by his sister and her grandchildren, some of whom have been invited to come up to the platform and receive the old lady's embraces and blessings.